Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, will this send me spiraling out of my routine? Time to consult the online experts.
Hi, Felicia here with 1 million followers. That bite will destroy your metabolism.
Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning. Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again? Oh, the kids would really love this.
Insulin sensitivity.
Are we
Stop it.
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at signos.com. That's SIGNOS.com with code SPARK. Signos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to 7 Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of 7 Deadly Sinners, the final episode on the absolute slime ball that is Tony Alamo. But before we walk our darkest journey of all with Tony and the Alamo Foundation cult, I just wanted to thank you extra big this week for making my heart completely burst with gratitude and a sense of accomplishment because of my 2 favorite ladies, the handmaidens of podcasting. I had to use the term handmaiden in kind of like a backhanded ode to Susan Alamo's ridiculous claim that she was the handmaiden of God. Anywho, because Ash and Elena of the Morbid Podcast made a weird and beautiful little podcast network, including 7 Deadly Sinners, we did a promo last week, and well, so many of you are here now. So thank you so much for binge listening over the weekend and reaching out, leaving awesome reviews, and I just want to thank all the new listeners as well as the OG listeners, and make sure you know that I appreciate you more than you could ever realize. And I'm so happy you care about these stories because I respect your opinion. You guys seem to be the kind of people I'd want to have a glass of wine with and talk shop. Everyone I've connected with seems so cool, and so many of you, it's so crazy, are actually a degree of separation or even directly connected to some of these cases. So it blew my mind. And yeah, I just wanted to say thank you. And please feel free to keep reaching out to us at 7 Deadly Sinners Podcast on Instagram. It will either be me responding or Greg Hunter, the guy behind the music and editing, who will respond. But we always share what we've read and who we've connected with each other. So basically, we hear you. I love your future case suggestions, and I love your personal stories where you've encountered false prophets similar to the cases we've covered. I'm actually even considering doing a once a month episode of your stories of, you know, coming across religious scams that have affected you, or your family member stories, or even like the leader of a self-help group turned cult leader a la Keith Raniere or something like that. Like, you know, stories of falling into something. I think it's important to point out the bad guys and gals so the good guys and gals in the religious or self-help communities can thrive, so we can try our best to avoid being victims of con artists. And just a heads up, you're going to be seeing some promos from the other Morbid Network shows showing up on our feed, and I hope you check them out because they are a group of badass, spooky podcasters, and I think you guys are going to fall in love with them. Okay, now for the nitty-gritty. Sadly, many of the people who were supposed to be keeping the children of the Tony Alamo cult safe failed them. The most vulnerable were not only subjected to horrific beatings, as we heard in last episode, now Tony was about to evolve into a proud and belligerent child sexual abuser, completely unashamed and unapologetic about his beliefs that he cherry-picked and distorted from the Bible, claiming that God wants you to marry and abuse underage girls, according to Tony. He would go on news programs in a tirade, defending himself and yelling live on the air at the host if they didn't agree. Tony Alamo was truly the poster child for the Messiah complex. But I don't think that Tony actually believed he was a savior. I think once Susan died and the cult was in his hands, he played prophet in order to become an abusive sexual predator who could finally act out his disgusting fantasies and hide in the pages of the Bible and a half sentence here or there of scripture that he distorted to validate it. It was in the early 90s when Tony began to slowly indoctrinate his followers to be comfortable with polygamy and eventually child brides. He would slip it in here and there and force them to do call and response sermons so the affirmations would come from their mouths as well, in very brainwashed sounding responses. Let's listen again to the clip we played last episode, and please pay special attention to the monotone way in which his followers are responding.
Does the law state that it's all right to have two wives?
Yes.
Is that evil?
No.
Why? Because God is the sum of moral excellency, and there is no darkness in him. None. Amen?
He ramped up this type of rhetoric more and more. And one of the ways he normalized polygamy and underage brides was to also marry the young girls off to other older men in the church. I'm guessing here, but perhaps Tony's mentality was that, like, hey, bro, you're doing it, so you can't question your leader for it. It's very similar to Warren Jeffs, who we covered in season one. In his cult, he was the biggest sexual predator of all, but he also arranged many young girls to marry older men, even taking them in a child bride pipeline from Canada to his compound. It's further indoctrination. Now everyone is in it together, so Tony can continue to mutate and get worse and worse, and everyone will turn a blind eye. No one's going to snitch on the other one if they're all doing it. It became constant. Tony fed this idea to his followers.
Having two wives or more is not sin if the Lord gives them to you. The Lord has given me three.
Now, what else is written in the book of Jasher? Let's talk about Rebecca and also her husband, Isaac. How old was Isaac when they married? Wasn't he 40 years old and she was 10? He was 30 years older.
God commanded young women to get married, and when they start their periods, they are women according to God's word. They should be able to be married at 13, 14, 15 years old. And in some cases, if they menstruated already, 12 years old. The government does condone child sex, but they don't condone them to get married to somebody old enough to be able to support them.
So all of these young girls are being given to these older men to marry. But then, in a bizarre 180, Tony began to kick the husbands of these young girls out with reckless abandon for sometimes absolutely no reason at all. What could the motive be for this? Tony always has a motive. Tammy, a former member who, after her escape, wrote a letter that was posted to the watchdog site Tony Alamo News. Her story is this. Tammy was originally married off before Tony kicked her husband out in order to take her for himself. Tammy, it seemed, actually really loved her husband and was heartbroken when Tony forced him out for some minor office infraction, but she had no way of knowing how much worse it was about to get. As her husband is rushing out, telling Tammy he had to leave or it would get worse for her if he drug her down, feeling so brainwashed that at least Tammy would be okay if he left, since Tony had the target on his back and not hers. As he was rushing out, Tammy could hear Tony ranting from the speakerphone saying, "Is he gone? Good. Make sure that bastard is gone. God won't bless this ministry with people like him around, insolent bastard." Randy vanished. Tammy was so distraught that one night she went to speak to Tony, her pastor, the only pastor she had ever known, to see if he'd be willing to ask God to give Randy another chance. But what ensued was several hours of emotional and spiritual deception and coercion. They went back and forth for 6 hours, and sometimes she had glimmers of hope, thinking that Tony heard her wishes and was considering them. She said he was being very kind and understanding, even offering her a drink of water. He said that she was intelligent and not at all the way that he had thought she was. Then, suddenly, Tony took her hand and said she was to marry him. Then he asked her to be his wife. In a fog of confusion, she couldn't believe what was happening. She went there to ask if Randy could come back, and now Tony was telling her she had to marry him? Here she was, 17 years old. In another room, his current 5 wives had her child. She was alone, with no car, no money, no telephone, no options. She wanted to go get her baby, but then her brainwashing came back to her. If I leave, will God kill my baby? She thought. As these thoughts are racing through her head, Tony squeezed her hand and said, "You haven't answered me," in a tone that meant, "God is displeased with you." She knew right then that there was no way out, and she said yes. Immediately afterwards, she felt so remorseful. Her love, her life had all vanished in a second. Then, Tony squeezed her arm and said, "Good girl." She felt relief for just a few seconds, thinking, "Okay, I keep him happy for a bit. Now I can just go get my child and start planning, and I'll leave in the morning." Tony spoke over her thoughts and said some words she couldn't remember, and then he kissed her on the head. Please note, the following and much of the rest of this episode contains depictions of child sexual abuse, physical abuse, and mental abuse, so please take care when listening. After kissing her on the head, Tony then asked her if she wanted to go into the other room. At first, she thought he only meant the conference room where her baby was. But then she realized he was expecting something. His intense stare watched her closely, and she knew the other room was his bedroom. The following is directly in her words, and she's such a beautiful writer, I'm just going to read the next part from her letter. This is what Tammy said. Quote, "Fear shot through my body, and I told him that I did not want to, but I was trying to figure out how to get out of it. What happened to the whole virgin bride thing? In that moment, I wanted to run back home, back to my sweet husband, who would rather me never know his love than to force himself upon me. But patiently, Tony waited 5 minutes, and then he asked me again and again, and I said no. He stood up, took my hand, and tugged me in that direction. From there on, I was in victim mode, a surveyor of my actions, non-participant in the decisions. I realized that he very much meant for me to have sex with him right then. I tried to act cool and change the subject, but he pulled my arm in anticipation and he took me into the other room. My emotional consciousness watched, begging for mercy as I entered the dark room and he lay me on the bed. He asked me over and over what was wrong until I realized that I was shaking uncontrollably and sobbing. He said something like, "Women get emotional about this." I sucked it in, not wanting to be a woman, not wanting to give him anything I didn't have to. I asked him what he was doing to me. The clock across the room had red glowing numbers. So fitting. Looking back, I can only describe it as a heart that had once been mine had been stolen from me, cut from my person, and I was left too emotionally bled to death on the bed that I would vomit. He kept saying, "The blood of Jesus is against you, Satan," over and over again. Finally, it was over. The cold breeze of the air conditioner went on. I turned over and cried silently. I missed my husband. The worst night of my life, and he wasn't there to hold me. In Tammy's story, not only is it rape because she's underage, but it's rape because she told you no, Tony. She said no. And when it came to the younger girls, Tony started off slow. Besides the brainwashing tactic of slipping the idea of polygamy and child brides into his sermons and recorded talks, he began to choose young girls to come work in his home office. And the girls that worked in the home office also lived in Tony's house. This is when many began to suspect that those girls were his wives. And this is how one eventual child bride, Amy, would end up there. Some parents felt honored by this choice, including Amy's mother, who even began telling Amy at a young age that Tony is the only person she will ever marry. You see, most, if not all, of the child brides were born into the cult or came into it at a very young age by way of their parents who had signed their life away to the Alamos. Some parents were so brainwashed that they were proud, felt it an honor that Tony someday could choose their daughter to marry him. But not all mothers were willing to give their daughters up. One mother, of a girl named Katrina, was completely duped into it. In a letter she wrote to the watchdog site Tony Alamo News, Katrina's mother said that when Tony Alamo was in prison, he asked her if her 12-year-old daughter Katrina could come and stay at his house to be a companion to his stepdaughter Rebecca, who also had been a good friend to her daughter. They were homeschooled together. It sounded fine to Katrina and her mother. And at first, her mother heard from her daughter regularly, but after a while, the communication stopped. This bothered the mother, so she contacted Tony, and she told him she wanted her daughter to come back home. Tony, of course, rebuked her and told her she was interfering with God's will. But much to her relief, shortly after, her daughter was sent home. But the psychological damage of being exploited by Tony may have had a lasting effect on her young daughter. And finding this out after her daughter was returned to her was more than this mother could take. The house that the young wives lived in with Tony wasn't an enormous house, but it was big enough to house the girls and Tony again eventually. It had been described as catacombish in that a bunch of additions were added onto the house in kind of a choppy and haphazardly type way that could have been on purpose to keep things even more secret, but who knows. But the additions made it so you had to wind through narrow, confusing hallways to get from one room to the other, and then there were many small rooms where several of the girls would bunk up together. Now, I just want to reiterate that the timeline of Tony's crimes are not exactly reported in a linear fashion, but to make it clear, the taking of child brides began a little bit before he went to prison in 1994, continued during his prison time, including the selecting of future brides, and escalated when he was released. And Tony's first round behind bars was knocking at his door. Tony Alamo's Teflon coating was weakening, and criminal charges against him were beginning to look like they might stick. Between 1992 and 1993, he had several pending charges against him, but the feds had to prioritize their strongest case. The child abuse case we mentioned last episode regarding Justin Miller likely wouldn't be as strong, as Tony was never actually in the room when it occurred. So like many mob bosses before him, they had to go after the one thing they did have an absolute record of: money. The IRS case had to take precedence. The only way to put him away for any length of time would be to catch him for tax evasion. State and federal governments usually took a hands-off approach when it came to religious organizations, likely fearing the infringement of church and state. But when tax money was involved, this was just the loophole and motivation they needed. According to the LA Times, Tony was arrested in April of 1993 on tax fraud charges and indicted by a grand jury in Memphis, Tennessee, on charges of filing false income tax statements in 1985, as well as for failing to file returns from 1986 to 1988. Filing a false tax return is a felony and could result in up to 5 years in prison. This had been an ongoing battle between the IRS and the Alamo Foundation for years, and Tony kept sticking to his story that it just wasn't true, claiming he was framed. He was released on bond, and in celebration of his release, he invited several church members to have dinner with him in his Memphis home, where things got interesting. Sue Balsley, who had left and returned to the cult several times by this point, noticed a bunch of young girls at the dinner. Girls she had taught in school and even babysat. But this wasn't a normal dinner. Tony, at the head of the table, was surrounded by these young girls and was calling them his wives, kissing them, and putting his arm around them. Sue was aghast, completely unaware Tony was marrying these teenagers. What had happened in the time she was gone, or perhaps didn't notice, right under her nose when she was an active member? What Sue didn't realize was that this was only the tip of the iceberg. Tony must have felt that he was sitting pretty with his attractive young brides. But finally, when it seemed all hope was lost, Tony was convicted on June 8, 1994, on each and every last one of the tax charges. And in September of that year, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. And this time, he was held without bond due to bigamy and child bride rumors and statutory rape claims made during the trial, to which he pled the fifth. And the Arkansas authorities, for whatever reason, didn't pursue the child sexual abuse charges against him. Tony was moved to a federal prison in Florence, Colorado, where he continued to run day-to-day operations of his cult, almost more effectively from prison than out of prison. Being incarcerated only reinforced what his followers thought. He was being persecuted because he was a prophet. So the followers kept working and grinding on the compound. And on the various Alama-owned businesses, they kept making money. They continued to generate income and donate it all back to the ministry, aka Tony's fun fund, when he left prison. From prison, he would call the compound and get detailed financial updates from the followers. What's happening? How much money are you making? And he even invested in more real estate behind bars. How this guy got hours a day on the phone from prison, I'll never know. But in one of his phone calls, he ordered his followers to buy properties in Foak, Arkansas, a remote location perhaps most famously known for the legend of the Foak monster. Well, Foak was about to have another monster, tangible and active in his terrorizing of followers. This creature was captured in a 1973 movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which describes a Foak monster as something of a southern Sasquatch, a Bigfoot-type monster. And this is how they describe it.
Here in this primitive river bottom wilderness in southern Arkansas, along with deer, duck, crane, and beaver, lurks a creature that walks upright. Whether it is a man, a monster, or a myth, no one really knows. What we do know is the people around Foak, Arkansas say they have seen such a creature nearly 250 times since 1954. And that this creature, whatever it emits one of the most terrifying sounds ever recorded.
Man, we like having sex, and we like having drugs, and we like having sex with beasts, and we like to flirt with each other, and we like to have filthy drinks.
I apologize. In my hours of research and writing, that gave me a break of joy I can't even begin to describe to you. But besides being a place where he could rival the monster lurking in the town, Folk was perfect. It was small, remote, and with a population of 859 according to the 2010 census, it would be easy for the flashy Tony Alamo to gain notoriety and influence there. However, their Wikipedia now would state otherwise, as any mention of Tony Alamo either never existed or has been wiped out due to sheer embarrassment of letting that bloat monster ever set foot in their town. Still, with land purchased in Folk, Tony ordered everyone who had children throughout the entire ministry to pick up and move to the minuscule Arkansas place. Odd in light of the child bride accusations, no? Families began to migrate to Folk like ants to a wayward ice cream cone. And these children, unbeknownst to them, were being picked like they were items from a catalog by Tony. As Tony would solicit photos of the young girls who were still in the cult, he would have them brought to him in prison so he could select his future victims. And this is where Amy, who I mentioned earlier, was selected to be his wife, under the guise of working in his office and living in his home. She would be there waiting for him, helpless and unaware of his intentions when he got out of prison. In March of 1995, the state of California dropped felony child abuse charges against Tony due to the 7-year delay in prosecuting and the fact that he was currently serving the 6-year sentence in a federal prison on IRS charges. With his release date quickly approaching toward the end of 1998, Tony was informed that he was required to return Susan's body to her daughter before he could be released from prison. That's right. Her body was still MIA after being taken from the Georgia Ridge compound years ago. Susan's daughter had sued him for the safe return of her mom's body.
If my mother could come back, Tony Alamo would need to hide his fat butt under the biggest rock on the planet, because she was vain. She was really into how she looked. She cared about that stuff. She really cared about it. And for him to drug her around like a rotting piece of meat, oh, that's some kind of love.
And just like that, the casket was anonymously delivered to a funeral home. Susan was finally laid to rest at Memorial Park Cemetery in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Tony was released on December 8, 1998. Tony was under constant surveillance due to the conditions of his release when he joined his flock in Folk, Arkansas. He knew he had to become more secretive and focus his attention on what he could control behind closed doors, on his victims and his child brides. But before Tony left prison, the abuse had already begun. He had already started the process of grooming the young girls. One tactic that Tony used to groom the girls living in the house was to have one of his current wives talk to the new girl about sex using graphic details. From prison, Tony told one wife to recount to Amy, one of the newer girls, a sexual experience the child bride had had. Tony used this as a way for the child bride to pry out info from Amy to see if she was still a virgin and how much she knew about sex. He would also have girls that were living in the home brought to visit him in prison. And this is how Katrina's mom, who we mentioned earlier, learned of the disgusting world of Tony Alamo. She unwittingly was duped into allowing her child to be subjected to. You see, Katrina was returned home to her mother. And upon that return, Katrina told her mom the most horrific story her mom had ever heard about Tony Alamo. The perverted things he was doing and the appalling things he had poisoned her daughter with. When she would go to the prison along with the other girls to visit Tony, ranging in ages from like 11 to 17 years old, Tony wouldn't talk to them about the Bible. The mom expected that that's what was happening. No, Tony Alamo would tell them that they were to be his wives, and some already were. He warned them not to tell their parents because they wouldn't understand and may cause a scene. Katrina was given explicit details of everything from oral sex, how Tony and other little girl wives were going to have threesomes once he was out of prison. He also bragged about the supposed size of his penis and many other disgusting pornographic subjects that would repel any decent adult. Her daughter, who never watched TV or heard a cuss word, was freaked out by the things Papa Tony told her. But luckily, Katrina escaped having to be one of his brides. But she wouldn't escape witnessing Tony molesting her friends behind the prison walls. Katrina's mother and other former child brides, who also wrote letters describing how the creep got away with molesting these girls behind the prison walls on the Tony Alamo News website, would describe it like this. The girls would take turns being shields, and they would keep their eyes open for the guards or when the camera would turn away from Tony for a minute. So while visiting him, the youngest girls would sit on his lap, and he would talk dirty to them. And the older ones were told to rub near his groin, and he would fondle their breasts and, if possible, other anatomy. He also described to them the sexual perverted acts he intended to do with them when he was released from prison, including beatings and orgies. When Tony left prison, several new girls were already waiting for him in his home, completely unaware of what lay before them. Amy, who was under the impression that she was living at Tony's house simply to work in the office, said that immediately when Tony left prison and came home, the nightmare started right away. He took her to his bedroom and put a ring on her finger and said, "Now we are husband and wife." She obviously didn't want to marry Tony, but thought, "This is what God wants me to do. I'm stuck here. I can't fight it. Might as well make the best of it." And she says that's how all of the other helpless girls felt. They didn't want to have to be anywhere near him at this point, but they felt they had no choice. Amy recalls that when he was raping her, she would tell him that it hurt, and she would try and push him off, and he would look at her and say, "Don't do that. Really, don't do that." In a way, like she was pissing him off, and that was a bad idea. Amy was 14 years old when she was forced to marry Tony. Another extremely brave woman who would speak out about her abuse by Tony was Desiree. She was definitely no woman at the time. Both Desiree and Amy were interviewed for the Ministry of Evil documentary, and Desiree recalled that she originally came into Tony's house to visit her aunt, but not long after, she was also taken away by Tony, where he forced a ring on her finger and said they were married. Then Tony said to her, "You know, after the vows, you have to consummate the marriage." Then Tony laid her on a bed and raped her. She was 8 years old. When he raped her, he said, "It's going to feel good later on. It's like that with the other girls." He would publicly state his distorted and insulting justification and lies about how these girls wanted him. And they were already so promiscuous, he wasn't doing anything they hadn't already done. Listen to this.
How would you determine if a young female had reached puberty?
Well, they know that in my church, they'd come and say, "Hey, I've reached puberty. Can we get married?"
Women want sex more than men. Okay? So the women are the ones that lead the men on.
By the time women today are 15 years old, they've committed fornication maybe anywhere from 10, 15, 20 to 1,000 times.
And if you needed a snap back into the horrible reality that these were children, Amy said that she remembered thinking during Tony raping her, quote, "Okay, when this is over, I'm going to just be able to go outside and play with my friends." And he didn't just rape them. He physically beat them and verbally abused them daily. He wanted them under his thumb, so he tried to make them grow up to believe they were ugly, stupid, worthless. How one of them didn't spit in that fat 70-year-old man's face when he said that to them. But granted, I know why they didn't. They were terrified of him. But it's just so hard to hear this and not want to picture that visceral reaction.
Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK, Cygnos.
He would even broadcast his verbal abuse in his sermon, saying things like this, specifically about Amy.
Again, we had another interruption here. Somebody called on the phone, and Amy answered, and just like that, if you don't know even how to answer a phone. That isn't that hard to do. I'm trying to make a high image of this church. Some of you people do nothing but drag it down.
And when they displeased him, he would lock the girls in a room called the greenhouse, all by themselves, sometimes for up to months at a time. But what these girls didn't know is that former members were mounting a presence online that caught the eyes of the feds. On and off again cult member Sue Balsley had finally found the courage to leave the Alamo Foundation in her rearview mirror and never turn back. Her children told her about a website called FactNet, spreading falsehoods about what really happened to members of the organization, claiming any allegations of abuse were simply not true. Enraged, Sue began to post her own accounts of what happened over the course of decades that she spent with Tony and the horrors she witnessed, the beatings, rape, and underage brides. Other former members soon followed suit, posting their own experiences with the church to the website, and the FBI soon became aware of these posts. These first-hand accounts were just what they needed if they were going to get any child abuse charges to stick to the Teflon pastor. They just needed to convince one of the child brides to come forward. By this time, Tony had taken dozens of wives, the youngest just 8 years old. Back at the compound, some of the wives began to conspire against him, convinced taking such a young bride was just too much. The older brides, still under the age of around 14 to 17 years old, had to become protective adults toward Desiree, the 8-year-old I mentioned earlier. It was as if their maternal instinct, or just moral instinct, ignited a bravery in them. They began to protect and shield little Desiree and would talk back to Tony that she's 8. She's 8. You can't touch her. They knew they needed to get out of there. One day, Tony accused Amy of giving him a dirty look while she was working in the office. And then he began to come towards her and she blurted out, "I want a bus ticket." Tony snapped back, "If you ever leave, you're never coming back." And she replied, "That's what I mean. I'm leaving and I'm never coming back." Then she bolted out of the room and Tony gave chase, chasing her down the hallways. But the young teen was clearly far more agile and swift than the fat, sweaty old man, and she was able to get out the front door. It was June 9th, 2006. Amy stood outside at 9 p.m. when two of the other wives came out, per Tony's order, to take her to the bus station. She had escaped. She was 22 years old at the time, having been held captive and married to Tony since she was 14. Brave little Desiree was next. She found another aunt that would meet her at a designated pickup spot after she escaped. So on November 3rd, 2006, at 11:30 p.m. at night, Desiree took off through the woods, dodging security cameras, dodging guards, running for her life. She was 15 years old. After spending 7 years in Tony's abusive grasp, enduring being raped, mentally and physically abused, she would never have to set foot on that hellish compound again. But Tony continued to consistently groom additional young girls to become his wives. At the time of the raid, there were a half dozen clearly underage girls living in Tony's house that were either currently wives or were about to be married to him. For their entire lives, they'd done as Tony commanded, following the rules and values and morals he had set before them. They called him Papa Tony even before they met him. He was constantly ingraining in their minds that the government was evil. And he was playing videos over and over again of the raids in Waco, Texas that left scores of believers dead. The young brides were led to believe a raid was inevitable, and they lived in fear that it could be Waco all over again. He threatened them with recordings about what would happen to them like this.
They said, "If we don't get Tony Alamo on this one, we're going to figure something out to get him. And if you don't stop going to Tony Alamo's church, there's going to be as many bullet holes in you as there is going to be in him."
At this point, two of Tony's underage brides, Amy and Desiree, had escaped, and former church members informed authorities. At first, Amy wouldn't talk to law enforcement, but Desiree did, describing her experiences and the nude Polaroid pictures Tony would take and study of these children. She also led investigators to Summer, a bride Tony had taken at the age of 11 in 2003. Summer described a trip she had taken with Tony from Folk, Arkansas to Los Angeles, California, and how he raped her in the back of his Heaven bus. That was it. The FBI could now charge him with interstate transportation of a minor for illegal sexual purposes. The FBI prepared to raid the Arkansas compound and readied a search warrant. There was no telling how many young children and young brides they would find upon arrival. With the allegations of polygamy, underage brides, beatings of children, and child pornography, as well as transportation of a minor, the FBI SWAT team could enter Tony's residence. Finally, on September 20th, 2008, the SWAT team entered the lower portion of the house, guns drawn. Chaos and commotion ensued. The girls were understandably terrified and hysterical. But Slippery Tony, of course, was nowhere to be found. The FBI left no stone unturned and hoped to find the nude Polaroid photographs that Desiree had told them about. Tony, in a constant state of paranoia, unfortunately, always destroyed all evidence any time he caught wind of a potential raid. So only two Polaroid cameras and blank film was found, along with many ovulation tests and bottles of Viagra. In Tony's bedside table, dozens and dozens of wedding rings. Authorities use this evidence to attempt to gain custody of the ministry's children. The Department of Homeland Security was instructed to remove any child under the age of 18 from all of the Alamo properties. News outlets began to expose these alleged crimes against Tony as he retaliated and promised the children's parents he would get their kids back. Kids were ripped from their parents' arms by Child Protective Services, but even still, the parents continued to believe Tony was a prophet from God. The children were being taken away not just to protect them from Tony, but from their own blinded parents. The minors were placed in foster care. But if parents agreed to leave the church, they could get their children back. Some packed their bags and left the ministry, but tragically, many did not. Tony was a fugitive, and the FBI continued their pursuit. They narrowly missed capturing him at the LA compound where he had been hiding at the time of the raid. This is when Tony began taunting the news media, calling into live broadcasts to spread his propaganda.
Tony, I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to ask you, isn't it true that you were accused in the past of polygamy, and that for those at home who aren't sure what that means, it means including marrying young girls, girls that are younger than the age of consent, marrying them to older men that eventually would want to have sex?
That isn't true. Polygamy is in the Bible, and it's condoned by God. Now, if you weasels have got a complaint about God, you go to him and talk to him about that. I just preach the Bible. And
right,
I have
but
the
marrying
right
to a minor is not necessarily something that you would say God would condone, right?
I never married any minor.
But a lot of polygamous compounds, as you know, do marry children that are underage, and a lot of child abuse takes part in that. I mean, that is a fact. You have to admit that that does go on in this country, and God's got nothing to do with that.
Well, God does have something to do. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. The Bible states that the legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir, and I went to Bible class every Sunday school, and I don't remember saying anything about
it. Teach you,
I mean,
because
kids
it's
are reaching puberty at the age of 12.
Anything. You don't know anything about the Bible.
So you're telling me the people that are 12 years old should be able to marry a 40-year-old, and that's okay?
What do you say?
You're saying that it's okay for a 12-year-old to marry a 40-year-old as long as she has reached puberty?
Well, in the Bible, if you read the book of Jasher, you'll see that Rebecca was 10 years
old. Don't tell me about the Bible, man. I'm a Jew. We wrote the Bible. Let me teach you.
Okay.
You don't know anything about the Bible, okay,
all right,
friend? All right?
So you're saying the Bible gives you the right to have sex with girls?
I have the right to have sex with my wife. Is there any problem with that?
No, absolutely no problem. No problem with your wife.
Most people are homosexuals today, like the people at the Vatican and everything.
Yeah, let's not talk. Let's not go there, sir. But let's try and stick to the issues.
Let's go there. Come on now. Come on. You know there's a bunch of faggots over there, and nobody's prosecuting them.
Tony simultaneously managed to embarrass himself and insult several different groups of people in a matter of less than 30 seconds there. You gross fool, Tony. The prophet was becoming unhinged. He hadn't been caught yet, and he had been using a cell phone that he thought no one knew about. Never underestimate the FBI, Tony. They were able to put a tracker on his cell phone, and he was physically located to a small hotel in Flagstaff, Arizona. They got him. But he had to be indicted in 30 days or he would be released. Since no child pornography was found, the only federal violation that they could charge him with was related to Summer being transported across state lines. 2 years after her escape, former child bride Amy finally agreed to testify against him. She helped Summer and all of the other girls that had escaped. Others followed her lead, and five former wives agreed to share their trauma in front of a judge. Tony was finally indicted on 10 counts of interstate transportation of a minor for sex. By the time of the trial began, there were 25 or 30 witnesses willing to testify, people who had witnessed beatings, endured beatings of their own, and those who had been members of the Alamo organization since its inception. It was difficult for these witnesses to share their experiences, but they wanted Tony to pay for what he did. It was especially difficult for the former child brides to give their statements. Considering some of their own parents doubted their claims, many feared that the jury would doubt them too. But in July of 2009, in the Texarkana Federal Courthouse, Tony was finally found guilty. Not just of one count, or two, or three. He was found guilty on all 10 counts. He was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. 175 years to be exact. The judge gave him the maximum sentence. Tony Alamo Ministries had become a criminal enterprise that had to be eradicated. And finally, after 18 lawsuits spanning four decades, the Teflon pastor had been taken down. A legal team led by David Carter had won over $1.1 billion to go to the children who were raped and beaten by Tony. Over the next few years, Tony was shuttled between several federal prisons. Some of the parishioners maintained contact and continued to kind of haphazardly run the ministry. The compound at Sagas housing the biggest group. Several of his wives still continued to live together, but it wasn't the same, thank God. Naturally, Tony refused to give up, filing appeal after appeal. One filed in 2012 in which his legal team argued that corporal punishment was reasonable in certain circumstances. The appeal was rejected. A judge also denied a motion to vacate Tony's conviction in November of 2014 after Tony argued his lawyers were ineffective and the government withheld information that could have helped him. No one could have saved you, Tony. You dug your own grave. None of your appeals would work at this point. You're done. Tony Alamo died on May 2nd, 2017, in a North Carolina prison. He was 82 years old. It was the end of the Alamo era. The greedy hex was finally lifted off his followers. But his victims, the child brides, would go on to become beautiful, thriving adults who speak out on various documentaries and TV shows, no doubt helping others to avoid the horror they endured under Susan and Tony Alamo's nightmare-filled reign. This concludes the Alamo series. Next week, we will take a turn into a hard-hitting self-help group of sorts, which I get to interview a close friend of mine after his experience being thrust into an abusive organization that his parents signed off on sending him as a child. But until then, thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoy the show, the best thing you can do is to tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps the show.
Because it's Bible, I have a right to preach the gospel, don't I? Okay.
Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.